Happy almost New Year's, everyone. This is The Takeaway. Tomorrow marks the end of a week-long celebration of Kwanzaa. We're talking about how different it looks this year.
It's a gathering. It's about ingathering. It's about coming together. And I'm like, well, we can't come together. But yet we have seen how people have ingathered.
I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega. And today on the show for Thursday, December 31st, how this year's celebration means so much more due to the racial uprisings that happened in 2020. Also on the show, how poetry is bringing you hope in a time of darkness.
What better way to find your voice, to lift your voice, than through this beautiful language that we call poetry?
Plus, in a year where big tech was such a huge part of our lives, we grapple with needing their products, but how their companies behave ethically. It's The Takeaway. I'm Callie Crossley, commentator and host for GBH Radio and TV in Boston, in for Tanzina Vega this week. Happy New Year's Eve to you as we happily bid adieu to 2020 tonight. Looking back on this year, I think it's safe to say that almost nothing went as expected, and we faced enormous loss. Over 343,000 friends, family, and fellow humans in the U.S. died in 2020 due to COVID-19. Millions of Americans also lost their jobs as entire sectors of the U.S. economy shut down to slow the spread of COVID-19. All of our lives changed dramatically. The pandemic and stay-at-home orders that accompanied it meant many of us were sitting in our apartments and houses more than ever before. To bridge the gaps, we doubled down on our reliance on tech giants. Zoom replaced the office, Amazon and Instacart replaced the grocery store, and Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram helped us seek out human interaction. But even as our dependence increased, we've continued to learn about labor and privacy issues with some of these companies, driving many of us to grapple with the question of whether we really need them and how to quit. Regardless, our changed relationship to big tech will surely have long-term effects that we have only just begun to see. Here with me now is Brian Patrick Green, tech ethicist and director of technology ethics at the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics, and John Herman, who covers tech and media for the New York Times Style section and the magazine. Brian, John, thank you both for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
John, let's start with you. How did the pandemic change how we interact with Amazon and other large tech companies like Google and Facebook?
I mean, across the board, whatever your relationship with these companies was before, it's probably become, for lack of a better word, more intimate. With Amazon in particular, I think the big crunch earlier in the year when people were worried about staying at home, having what they needed, that really formed a lot of new habits for people and reinforced some old habits. The demand was so great that it kind of, for a brief time, brought Amazon to its knees. But since then, it's ramped up capacity, and it has had, you know, in generally a pretty difficult year, a very good year.
Is it even possible to walk back how dependent we've become?
This is something that I think a lot of people are starting to feel. Now, this year, and I would imagine next year, more people turned to Amazon than turned away. But a lot of people started to feel a bit trapped. I mean, if your shopping options are limited in the physical world around you, you're turning to e-commerce. And if you really focus on e-commerce, you start to notice that for certain types of things, for certain needs, Amazon is not the only game in town, but certainly the most convenient. So I think there is a growing awareness, at least among the different people that I talk to who are trying to avoid Amazon, that their choices are kind of diminishing, or they can see ways in which in the future their options might be limited.
So, Brian, it isn't just Amazon. It's Google. It's Facebook. As a tech ethicist, how do you approach our relationship to tech?
Well, first of all, what I would say is that these companies provide something that people want. That's the reason they exist in the first place. But then the question becomes, are they providing it in a way that's actually helpful to the whole world? Is this something that we feel comfortable with? Is it something that bothers our conscience? Do we feel that the workers, for example, are not being treated correctly? And this is really a time when we need to think about how we behave, how we act in the world, and how can we work to make sure that the future that we're creating together is really somewhere that we want to live.
So how does someone like Amazon founder Jeff Bezos or Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg think about the products and services they provide? Do we know? And have they been held account to that?
Well, this is a great question. I mean, first of all, they've built huge companies. They obviously have a great amount of business sense. But then the next question is, do they really have a sense of how their products are operating in the world, how people are interacting with them? Do they really recognize the impact that they're having in terms of the negative impacts, especially whether it's on their own workers or whether it's on people in other countries or in our own country?
So, John, Amazon's reach is massive. It doesn't just deliver books and toilet paper. Give us a sense of just how big its scope is at this point.
For a story recently, I talked to a wide range of people who are trying to disentangle themselves from Amazon. And they were avoiding Amazon for all sorts of different reasons. They probably would have disagreed with each other if they were in the same room talking about this. But one thing they had in common was that they found it was pretty hard. It's one thing to shop less on Amazon.com or to avoid Whole Foods or to unplug your Echo smart speaker. But if you're using the internet, let's say you're using Zoom more for work this year, you're indirectly using Amazon Web Services. If you're watching Netflix more this year, you're indirectly using Amazon Web Services. Amazon's holdings include all sorts of different companies, some better known like Zappos, but if you're using IMDb, you're also sort of in the Amazon universe. Audible, Twitch, and then of course the entertainment products with Amazon Prime Video. So someone I talked to who has spent his life, Chris Smalls, this year protesting Amazon. He was a warehouse worker who led a walkout and then was eventually fired. He said that even his family had a hard time extracting themselves from Amazon and their habits that they had formed with Amazon. So it's not easy to fully avoid the company, even if you make that choice and even if you're pretty well devoted to it. And it really doesn't seem like it's going to get easier.
But Mr. Smalls also said that he asked the question, what did you do before all this? So, encouraging people to think about ways of moving away.
It's true. I mean, a lot of people I talked to felt a little bit of guilt and uneasiness. They are people who had maybe ethical concerns about Amazon or political concerns about Amazon, but they were still making an exception for one product or another. It is true that if you really do set your mind to it, you're not going to be able to avoid touching Amazon, especially with the way that it undergirds so much of the internet. But you can move a lot of your business elsewhere. And one thing that came up with a number of sources that I thought was interesting was that it's, perhaps not so helpful to focus on avoiding Amazon with all of its diversified products and everything. It's more helpful to think about where you're taking your business and what effect that might have, because making a choice to buy at a local bookstore, for example, means a lot more to that store than the lack of business could ever mean to Jeff Bezos.
Brian, you spent time advising tech companies about the intersection of tech and ethics. What can you tell us about the kinds of questions you're helping them answer?
Well, they're really asking questions about they're really concerned about how they're operating the world right now. I've got this as firsthand information from people who directly work for these companies, and not just at the lowest levels, but higher up too. I think a lot of them have had their consciences stoked by what's happened in the last 4 years since 2016 in the election and all the way up through the pandemic and now. And they realize that they're having an impact on the world, which is not the positive impact that they thought that they were going to have. And so this has really caused an opportunity in their minds to try to reinterpret the way they're looking at the world and to reevaluate their behavior and try to become better, not just as individuals, but of course as a corporation. But it turns out that that's actually quite difficult if you've developed habits now that have been going on for years. If your business model, for example, relies on scooping up large amounts of information. So they really have to think about not only how to improve their products, not only how to improve things day to day, but really how to think big picture of how their corporation is operating in the world.
But Brian, Amazon and Facebook have both come under scrutiny for their labor practices. Amazon's been accused of providing unsafe working conditions during the pandemic. Facebook content moderators have reported being traumatized after reading hate speech and watching violent acts. How have these organizations addressed these issues, and have their efforts been substantial enough?
So these are incredibly important questions. I think most people would agree that they're still working on it. They need to work harder. These are issues that ultimately they affect the bottom line, right? It costs money to do these sorts of things. And because these are corporations that are predominantly preoccupied with making money, that's always going to be the first thing on their mind, which unfortunately pushes ethics to the side. But I think they really need to think a little bit longer term, not just short term in terms of the money this quarter or this financial year, but in terms of what their overall impact is on the world. Do we want to live in a world where these sorts of things are going on, where people are being treated badly, where people are being traumatized? How do we make a better world together where we are controlling these negative aspects of technology and really trying to seize on the opportunity and promise that technology can give to the world?
John, why do you think we've heard so little when it comes to enacting legislation that could actually address some of the issues we've raised regarding Amazon's size?
You know, a lot of the discussion about reining in the tech giants or introducing new regulations, you know, with antitrust concerns, it's been focused on Facebook and Google. And it's easier for regular internet users to sort of understand, let's say, Google's dominance. I mean, there are other search options, but Google, if you use it for email, it's really just so central in your life. The idea of leaving it is genuinely kind of hard to think about. The antitrust concerns with Amazon are not so visible from the surface. The main issue right now, where a lot of these discussions and fights are happening, it's the sellers. It's Amazon's power as a channel for people to sell things. Majority of the products sold through Amazon are actually sold through third parties by individuals and businesses who are just using Amazon as a way to reach customers. Now, this also isn't apparent to most customers, but this is where there are a lot of emerging concerns that, for example, Amazon might watch what sellers are doing and then move into that space themselves later, or that they might introduce unfavorable terms for sellers that put undue pressure on people who are just trying to make their living selling online and don't really have a better option. So I think the reality of Amazon's market strength and its dominance will become more apparent to people in the coming years. But I think big parts of it will remain kind of less visible. They don't really make for the same sorts of rallying cries that you get around Facebook and free speech, for example, or around Google and search dominance, which is pretty easy to get across.
Brian, what kinds of questions should our listeners be asking themselves if they want to make more conscientious decisions when deciding what tech companies they want to spend their time and money with?
I think it's always important to think about what the ethical impacts are of what we're doing. And yes, I think that people should always be thinking about what the right thing is to do, especially with regards to tech.
I think the first step in this process is to take stock and think about if you did choose to leave one of these big firms, how could you do it and how easy would it be?
And if you're determined to do it, then maybe you can find a way to do that. All right. Brian, John, thank you both for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Patrick Green is a tech ethicist and director of technology ethics at the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics. And John Herman covers tech and media for the New York Times Style section and the magazine.
I woke up, found ways to be productive, connected with nature and those I love. I'm filled with gratitude and ever thankful and grateful to be alive. Carpe Diem. Journal Excerpt 2020, Charlotte Flournoy, Tennessee.
I'm Callie Crossley. This is The Takeaway, and we've been thinking about hope.
Got a feeling 21 is gonna be a good year. Especially if you and me see it in together.
On this last day of 2020, I've been reflecting on endings and beginnings. For me, art, especially poetry, is one way to process and commemorate both loss and hope. Two things very much on my mind as we welcome 2021. We ask you if there are poems or other pieces of art that have inspired you this year. We got so many wonderful responses. Here are just a few.
Hi, it's Barbara McIver in Red Bluff, California. And a poem that has really moved me more than ever this year is Elizabeth Bishop's One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day, accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of this will bring disaster. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I own, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
My name is Julie Bailey from the Bronx. And what has really inspired and sustained me is a James Baldwin quote, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." I kind of think that that sums up the current situation, at least in America. And it is also something that has given me personal strength, because I've changed a lot of things this year.
Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. Hope is the Thing with Feathers by Emily Dickinson was sent to me inside a card by a friend after I announced my breast cancer diagnosis. The news that my irregular mammogram was most likely cancer came on the same day that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. And that was confirmed 2 weeks later on my birthday. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm.
For me, a poem from my favorite poet, Lucille Clifton, seems right for this moment. The Lesson of the Falling Leaves. The leaves believe such letting go is love. Such love is faith. Such faith is grace. Such grace is God. I agree with the leaves. Poetry is an art form that allows us to mark some of our darkest moments and celebrate our most joyful ones. We wanted to hear directly from poets themselves about how they process the events of 2020, both in their own writing and through the work of others. Joining me now is Javier Zamora, a poet, writer, and educator. Thanks for being here, Javier.
Thank you for having me.
And Kwame Alexander, author of Light for the World to See, 1,000 Words on Race and Hope, and founding editor of Versify. Welcome, Kwame.
Hey there. Good to be here.
Glad to have you. Kwame, was 2020 a productive writing year for you?
Absolutely. I was living a writer's dream in the midst of a nightmare. I had nothing to do but sit in my house and, you know, tell my kid to turn off her screen, stop watching a movie, read. And I just sat there and wrote. And I wrote so much. My imagination just went wild trying to write myself out of the uncertainty, out of the chaos, and try to create a world, try to dream a world, as Langston Hughes would have said, for myself.
Javier, what about you? Have you found it harder to be creative during the pandemic?
The beginning was extremely difficult for me to write. I was worried. I was living in a very small apartment in New York City. I didn't start writing until late August, maybe September. So it's been a struggle.
So you've written, Javier, a lot about your past in your work. Is it more of a challenge for you to write about significant events as they're unfolding?
That is true. I think because of the nature of a lot of what I write about, which is my immigration story when I immigrated here when I was 9. And so the pandemic, the world crumbling around me and my internal world, the stuff that I write about being so hard to write about, I think it's been very difficult.
Kwame, you published a new book this year, and we'd just love to get a sense of the work you've done in 2020. Can you read us something from that?
You know, like Javier shared, I sort of went through this period where I didn't know how to articulate what I was feeling, the uncertainty of the pandemic, the racial injustice. And so the killings of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, they drove me to a place where, as Toni Morrison said, I didn't have a choice. I had to write my way out of the despair. And so I wrote a piece called American Bullet Points. We can't be ourselves. We can't be at home. We can't be alone. We can't be unarmed. We can't shoot ourselves. We can't hold a gun. We can't hold a toy. We can't hold a phone. We can't do a thing. We can't drive a car. We can't walk the street. We can't ride a bike. We can't run away. We can't be a boy. We can't be a man. We can't be afraid. We can't break these chains. We can't walk. We can't run. We can't dream. We can't be. We can't breathe. We can't live. We can't breathe. We can't live. But we will not die. And so that's an excerpt from a piece I wrote called American Bullet Points.
Wow. What was the process of writing that poem like for you?
The process was, you know, not being able to sleep, not being able to watch the video of this police officer's knee on the neck of this black man, you know, not having answers for my daughter, understanding that this wound is very old, that in America, that we have been suffering under the weight of being black for 400 years in this world, and needing to not go crazy. And how do I go when crazy? And for me, it's always been about the words on the page. It's been about writing as a way of writing myself into a sanity or a better state of mental health. And so I just sat down and sort of started thinking about all the things that we can't do in this world as a black man, as a black person, whether you're jogging, whether you're in your apartment, whether you are breathing. These are things that are you know, are life-threatening. And we've seen that time and time again. And so I wanted to write about that idea of what we can't do, which is interesting because when I looked at the pieces, at the refrain and the lines and the stanzas, of course, all of these things we have done. And so that was sort of the juxtaposition that while we can't do it, we have done it. And as Langston Hughes said, we're still here.
Javier, you're speaking with us from Tucson, Arizona, which is pretty close to the U.S.-Mexico border. Do you think conversations around immigration and deportations have gotten overshadowed during the pandemic?
I think they tend to be overshadowed outside of that pandemic, and especially now, and conversations around the Latinx community in this country as being one of the communities that's being most impacted by the pandemic. We have one of the highest death tolls. And so ingrained in that as well is the conversations that are happening around the southern border. I am here to research my memoir that I'm writing and research some new poems in the area in which I crossed in 1999 as a 9-year-old. And to this day, when I drove to the border, I saw on Thanksgiving day a helicopter chasing immigrants. And I did not find that anywhere in a newspaper. And it's hard to find what Border Patrol is doing. They've changed their recent policies in which if you get detained, they're immediately deporting you across the border back into the hands of the cartel.
How do you channel that onto the page?
For me now, I think the pandemic has reminded me that a lot of my personal content is very traumatic and therefore, for the most part, sad. So I'm trying to change that narrative. So I've been writing about the joy, but immediate joy that was very hard for me to find at the beginning of the pandemic and still to this day. For example, I love dancing and I love eating food. I love being at a restaurant. And so a lot of my poems are about just eating Salvadoran food because that's been very difficult to find.
Javier, you've talked a lot about trying to create empathy through your poetry. What impact do you think the pandemic might have on the amount of empathy U.S. citizens extend to immigrants?
I am hopeful that the pandemic is showing Americans a glimmer of the daily lives of undocumented immigrants in this country. In my personal case, I wasn't able to travel back to my country for 20 years. I have family members who are still undocumented, who are afraid to drive to a next town. They are afraid that they can't travel anywhere as we please. And so hopefully this lockdown, this inability of seeing loved ones over holidays can opened a huge door for what the lives of undocumented immigrants are in this country.
How do you think writers can play a role in making sure people do find more space for empathy?
I think what Kwame was saying too, I think it's our role to imagine a future outside of this pandemic and a better future. I hope that all the time that we've had in our homes, we have also taken to look inward and look inward first in order to make the outward world better for each and every one of us.
Kwame, much of your work is geared toward kids. How do you try to connect with kids through poetry this year, particularly this year?
I think kids need their voice. They need to know that they matter. Children need to have a way of channeling all the uncertainty that they're feeling during this lockdown, during this pandemic. What better way to find your voice, to lift your voice, to build confidence than through this beautiful language that we call poetry, this concise, rhythmic, and figurative language? I've always posited that a lot of adults, a lot of teachers and educators, they shy away from verse. They're afraid of it. And they translate that into our kids don't like poetry. And I believe that that's so far from the truth. It's the opposite, that children actually love poetry and that adults love it. They've forgotten that they love it. You think about how we learn how to speak, write, listen, and read. And we learn through lullaby. We learn through, through rhythm and rhyme. We learn through Dr. Seuss. And we learned, through Shel Silverstein. And I think something happened around third, fourth, fifth grade. And the poetry, it began to become staid and incomprehensible. And so by the time you get to high school, you have kids who are reading, Shakespeare and Robert Frost. And their words, of course, are beautiful. But how can you expect a child to sort of go from Shel Silverstein to Shakespeare and still have that same level of appreciation and engagement? And I think you can't, for the most part. And I try to write poetry. I try to share poetry. I try to encourage young people to access poetry that's relatable and accessible, and that's going to serve as a bridge to get them to appreciate poetry in the way that I know that they can.
So what's your approach to talking to them about the kinds of serious topics that were so resonant with this year? How do you present to them in ways that make sense for younger readers?
Yeah, again, I think it's a great question, but I think the answer is in the question. I had a 12-year-old kid and so I dealt with this every day. And so my response was, I'm not going to sit here and tell you why I think, you need to use poetry as an outlet. I'm not going to show you the benefits of poetry. I'm just going to share a poem. I went down to the river. I sat down on the bank. I tried to think but couldn't, so I jumped in and sank. I came up once and hollered. I came up twice and cried. If that water hadn't been so cold, I might have sunk and died. Though you may hear me holler and you may see me cry, I'll be dogged, sweet baby, if you're going to see me die, because life is fine. Life is fine. That's Langston Hughes. I'm just going to share a poem. The poetry will do the work. Javier's poetry about Salvadorian food will do the work of helping people become empathetic, because it shows them that people of color, Latinx kids, black kids, brown kids, breathe, love, eat, dance, smile, just like everybody else. The poetry will do the work, Callie.
Okay. Javier, you were able to find some space for joy in your poetry, writing about the food, as Kwame said. What inspired you to write about the experience eating a pupusa for a poem that I hope you will read for us now?
The inspiration was my grandma was a pupusera. I grew up in a street side stand. And for a while, even in California, I came here in 1999. It was hard to find a Salvadoran food-only restaurant. And so during the pandemic, I remember those days. And we are, for the most part, in those days still, where I think the election just showed us that Latinx are not one monolith, but we have different communities within. And so I wrote this poem, and this is an excerpt. No, actually, soy salvadoreño. El Salvadorean, Salvadoran, Salvadorian, los muy muys. We don't even know what to call ourselves, how to eat a pupusa, fork and knife, or open it up and treat it like a taco. We didn't listen and came here only to be called Mexican or Puerto Rican, depending on the coast. We had to fight for our better horchata, not the lazy, wider one with only rice. And when we didn't want to fight, we try to blend, speak more Mexican, more ira, more popote, more no pos wow. No majes, no se me hagan dundos, pónganse trucha vos. When anyone wants to call you Mexican, you can just say, no, actually, andate a la M, racista, cara de nacionalista.
Ooh, I love it. To you both, what work by other poets resonated most with you this year?
I read a lot of Nikki Giovanni this year. Nikki Giovanni is very sort of Southern, homespun, familial in her words. And so, you know, they're almost like recipes, her poems. And so I got a lot of that home feeling, which was necessary because you can't see your family. You know, you had to stay in the house. I read a lot of Neruda, read a lot of love poems. You know, that's one of the things that hasn't been talked about a lot is how do you love, you know, how do you love during this pandemic? How do you, you know, long distance love, you know, let alone like, how do you love? And so I read a lot of Neruda. And of course, I read Langston Hughes for the humor and the reminder of our humanity that needs to be, you know, that we've been talking about during this conversation.
Javier, what about you?
I've been reading a lot of Amy Nezuta Matato. And what I love about her work, especially Oceanic, and now her recent prose, is that it's full of joy and just wonder. And I'm a huge fan of animals, and she includes an animal almost in every poem. And that has really been a wonder to read inside my home in the hardest days of the pandemic.
So last question. Speaking of joy, a number of Takeaway guests weighed in this year on where they found joy in 2020. What made both of you joyful this year? Javier, you can start.
Hiking. Just going outside of my house and just going out for a walk. Ideally at a park, and most ideally in at our local trailhead who's going up a mountain now here in Arizona. And so that's been my favorite part.
Kwame?
So that's interesting that, you know, that we have this in common, Javier, because I live in London. And this is my first time living in a city since I was a tween living in Brooklyn, New York. And during the lockdown and the pandemic, I discovered walking. I had never been a walker. I've walked Hyde Park, Regent's Park, Primrose Hill. I love walking. And one of the things I've discovered is, you know, I can walk 2 hours, a 2 hour, 7 mile walk through the city, through a park. And I come back and I'm fueled with, you know, with an imagination that's ready to just explode on the page. And it's because I've become this even more of a willing participant in life through the walking. And it's brought so much joy to me.
Javier Zamora is a poet, writer, and educator. And Kwame Alexander is the author of Light for the World to See, 1,000 Words on Race and Hope, and founding editor of Versify. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gay Edelman, Red Bank, New Jersey. What I Learned the Hard Way by Gay Edelman. There are those who say all the best lessons are learned from the pains of life. Sometimes I feel it's all been the hard way. I have learned people are frail and strong, unpredictable and trustworthy. I'm better than I know. Some people like me, some don't. Kicking and screaming, eyes wide closed, blinded by the dream, my life is not Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver. It is also not Taxi Driver, I walked out before the last bloody scene. Diversity, faces to the world, faces to faces. I have learned to start at the center. There is that of goodness in everyone. Seeds of peace, seeds of war. Evil comes from somewhere. I live in questions and in mysteries. I reach beyond the known in gracious and glorious company to anchor and soar, cycle and repeat.
The truth, so often obscured and omitted. And I find I have much to say to my Black children. Margaret Burroughs.
My name is Hannah Clark from Omaha, Nebraska, and I am a poetry major from college, a poet, but for all of 2020, I wasn't able to write a thing, it felt like. And then I was inspired by the simple act of kindness of giving someone a massage, rubbing neck and shoulders, especially with everything going on. I carried all my tension up in my neck, and when my partner would take time out of her busy day to rub my neck and shoulders, it gave me such hope in the simple human kindness of being present for each other. So I finally was able to write, and I wrote this. I will never tire of hearing. I will never tire of hearing you grunt as you work my muscles into submission. Please, massage the acid ropes that tie my hips to thighs, the granite chips in my neck, the wicked slivers in my spine. We do call them shoulder blades. Press me into juice with your delicious detachment. Touch me not as me, but as a thing, which frees me from awareness, from control, reminds me, passenger, to respect the meat that bears me and all the inevitable fractures of a body thrown through space, space that batters it, maybe, with love like yours, asking only that someday we return to the weightless spice of eternity when we have finally finished learning to forgive our bodies for being born.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Umoja, unity that brings us together. Umoja, unity that brings us together.
I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega. You're listening to The Takeaway. Tomorrow marks the final day of Kwanzaa, the annual week-long celebration honoring African and African-American culture. And like most holidays, Kwanzaa looks a lot different in 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has disproportionately impacted Black people in the U.S. Between that and the months of protests against systemic racism and police brutality, it's been a traumatic year for Black Americans, one that's made Kwanzaa and what it stands for especially resonant. Here to discuss that and more is Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University and author of the book Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Christina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Also with us is Karen Queen Noor Abdul Malik, teaching artist, director of the Folk Life Center at Perkins Center for the Arts, and an international storyteller known as Queen Noor. Queen Noor, Habari Gani.
Kumba Habari Gani.
That's right.
How are you?
For those of us who've never celebrated, Queen Noor, what is Kwanzaa and what does it celebrate?
Kwanzaa is a harvest holiday for African Americans and people of African descent in the greater diaspora. It began in 1966 and was founded by Maulana Karanga. I say it's a harvest holiday because all year long we plant our seeds of good. It might not be the seeds when Maulana traveled through Africa. He looked at the harvest holidays, how they would plant and work the land, and then they would have a celebration at the end. Sometimes it would be 10 days, 14 days, 21 days. And he said, we don't have the opportunity to have a celebration, a harvest celebration. And so Kwanzaa was engendered so that we can celebrate the good that we have planted in our community using seven principles all year long.
It's cultural, not religious, right?
Absolutely. It is a cultural holiday. It is not a religious holiday. However, it is spiritual because as Africans and people of African descent, we do not separate the spirit from the dailiness of our lives. But it is not religious and or acquainted or connected to any religion.
Christina, why was Kwanzaa created? How much of it was connected to the social unrest of the late 1960s?
Well, we have to remember that, you know, the Black Power movements of the 1960s and 70s created, in many ways, a similar parallel situation that we're witnessing today, where Black communities needed to come together to feel unified, to feel like they needed to define themselves and speak for themselves, to build and maintain their own organizations for their own protection and advancement. And we find ourselves in 2020, sadly, needing to do those same things because of the lack of real substantive racial progress that has been made in this country in certain institutions. And so when we think about the seven principles of unity and self-determination and collective work and responsibility and cooperative economics, you know, as we think about issues like defunding the police and how do we build and maintain our own stores and shops and businesses and work together and use money and resources and keep those in our communities, or purpose, or creativity. We've seen the beautiful creativity coming out of pain and anguish, which leads us into the final day, which is what it's all about in faith, you know, and how we push our hearts forward for a better society, for a better family, for a better community, and to better ourselves. And I think that's why to have faith, which is Imani, on January 1st is such a powerful way to end the celebration of Kwanzaa.
So back then, did it catch on right away, or did it take a few decades to become more widely recognized, Christina?
Well, I don't know how many African Americans in the United States celebrate Kwanzaa. I did not grow up celebrating Kwanzaa, and I have to be honest, this is the first year that I really, every year I look over the principles and, you know, reflect on them briefly, but I will say that this is the first year that I really read a lot more and each morning reflected on which of the principles of the day, what they meant to me, and actually had discussions with different friends and colleagues about that. I think, you know, interestingly enough, we saw how Juneteenth caught on this year after the tragic death of George Floyd. And so many corporations and companies and businesses around the country were thinking of real ways to celebrate and recognize Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. I haven't necessarily seen it in the same ways this year, but I am curious to see moving forward if a new generation of Black Americans and Black people in America will see this holiday as something of a reminder, especially after the hectic Christmas holidays, when people are allowed to be back with their families again, to think about these really seven important principles.
So, Queen, of the seven principles, including Umoja, unity, Nia, purpose, Kumba, creativity, which is today's principle, which Kwanzaa principle resonate with you this year in particular? Are there any that stand out?
Always Kujichagulia, self-determination, that's one that's always high on my list. That's because we have to name ourselves, define ourselves. And I'm really think about languaging this year. And as people are talking about anti-racism and as people are talking about white supremacy, labeling is very, very important how we look at that. And how we, what we define and call ourselves as. Even when you're going to write for a grant and the communities are marginalized or underserved, that we can flip that language and change that language so we define ourselves and identify ourselves with empowering words and for identity and to raise up our youth and our generations with empowering. Another one that's always important to me is Nia. Just yesterday, I saw Alicia Garcia and she had the purpose of power behind her book that she has written, and purpose is always, that's in my daily life. It is key. So are the seven principles, actually. We should work those seven principles, use those seven principles to impact our communities 365 days of the year. But knowing our purpose and understanding our greatness, because along with those seven principles comes the recommitment to our communities, the celebration of the good and of our history and of our strong foundation. Like the Makeka is our foundation. It's our root. And so We celebrate all of that as well. So the symbols are important that we place upon the table, as is every single principle. And this year, there's not a principle that's not aligned with moving our communities forward in terms of the Black Lives Matters movement, even in climate change, because our environment is important. So it's not a principle that is not apropos.
Christina, we saw countless white people and non-Black people of color observe or acknowledge other holidays like Juneteenth this year. Is Kwanzaa also being honored outside the Black community today?
I genuinely don't know. I haven't read any stories. This summer when we saw so many different types of people and cultures celebrating Juneteenth and recognizing it and writing about it and what it meant to them, I have not seen that same level of fervor. That doesn't mean it's not happening. I do think that there's some confusion about Kwanzaa still. As Queen Nora mentioned, it is not a religious holiday, but because it falls so closely within the Hanukkah Christmas time period, I think some people get a little confused and think that it is an African-American religious holiday, which it is not. I do think that it can be inclusive because of the seven principles that Queen Nora has laid out for us. I think it would be, especially in this time of collective healing in the United States, I would love to see a real substantive conversation about umoja, which is unity, or nia, which is purpose, or ujima, which is our collective work and responsibility, or, you know, thinking about school children who have not been in school for several months. How do we keep Kumba in creativity in their minds and hearts as they go back to virtual school in January? So I think that there is room for conversation and inclusion. I just don't know if many non-Black Americans have picked up this important celebration as something that they're interested in. And to be honest, I don't know how many Black Americans would feel comfortable necessarily with opening it in a specific way. I think that that would be a different type of conversation about what this holiday would mean if it's opened up to a wider audience without real conversation about why it was necessary and why it's still necessary for Black people in this particular country.
Queen Noor, you fought hard about not even having a celebration this year, even though now you decided to go forward with a virtual one. Why do you think this is important? And what do you see? What do you think about the resurgence of interest and the more widespread adoption of Kwanzaa in the future?
So I think that what happened was I was thinking in my mind, Kwanzaa, it's a gathering. It's about ingathering. It's about coming together. And I'm like, well, we can't come together. But yet we have seen from March how people have ingathered, how people have come together. I know a family that meets every Friday on Zoom. We have, you know, meetings in terms of businesses. I'm an artist, so there's been many meetings across the Zoom platform. It has blown up in other platforms as well. So we always find a way to ingather. And the thing about it is these principles, again, have to be lived 365. And as we're talking about correcting justice, you can look at these principles to say that we're going to do that. And so when you talk about in a broader sense, I've seen people come of different ethnicities to our Kwanzaa festivals in the past, but predominantly it is African Americans, and it is an African American holiday that is also celebrated in other parts of the world where there are people of African descent. We've seen people, the marches that are very integrated as people are marching towards justice. So the principles can apply to that, but we must have a way that we are saying why it was founded was to celebrate. We have to tell our own stories, because when we don't, what we do have is injustice, is inequity. So this is a way to keep us in a remembrance and recommitment to that.
Queen Noor is an international storyteller and director of the Folk Life Center at the Perkins Center for the Arts. And Christina Greer is an associate professor of political science at Fordham University and author of the book Black Ethnics. Thank you both for joining us, and happy Kwanzaa.
Thank you. Asante sana.
It's been a pleasure sitting in for Tanzina all week, and I'd like to send a huge thank you to the team who puts the show together. Our board operator for this week was Debbie Daughtry. Our director and sound designer is Jay Cowett. Jackie Martin is our line producer. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. The Takeaways producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Our digital editor this week was Dina Syed Ahmed. David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is the executive producer. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or send me a tweet at Callie Crossley. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Be safe tonight, and have a happy new year.